Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I'm just a caveman.
Due to habeas corpus, you and Miss Bonifante had a common law marriage.
So you don't work on a contingency basis?
No. Money down. Oops, shouldn't have this bar association logo here either.
Would you please point at that robot over there? No further questions.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode number 65. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. That over there is your host, Andrew Torres. How you doing, Andrew?
I'm great, Thomas. How are you?
Doing okay. Well, it's always out of time, unfortunately, because, you know, we're a week out now by the time people are hearing this. But it needs to be said that ReasonCon was really fun. And I said on my show, and I'm going to say it again. If you guys get the opportunity to go to some sort of live podcast, like anything like that, where it's podcasters you know and like, or it's a community you know and like, just do it. It's really fun. And we had a great time. My predictions were right. There was a throng of women just following Andrew at all times. And so how about you? Anything to say on that?
No, it was fantastic. I know you and I both had a great time. And there are still like two or three people who have hit us up on Facebook who were like, well, I saw you, but, you know, there were a lot of people talking to you and I was kind of nervous to come up and say hi. Like, please come up and say hi. Like, I mean, one of the great things about doing the show is we love getting a chance to meet you. And there is nothing better than having somebody come up and say, I love listening to your show. I care. Like, the greatest things are when people come up and are like, there was this news report that I was able to read and I knew to go to the underlying bill and I understood what that meant because of your show. And I was like, that's why we do the show. Right? Like, that's the whole point, is so you don't have to rely on, you know, what a reporter tells you what the law says, that, like, you know, you have the tools to do that on your own. So it's unbelievable. We love meeting you. We had a great time at ReasonCon. Please come up and talk to us.
Absolutely. And with that said, let's get to some of the explaining of things and helping people understand laws that they previously wouldn't have understood. Down. The law. Down. The law. Down. The law. Down. The law. All right, Andrew. First segment of the day. Everybody wants to know about the the fact that Trump is railing against the Ninth Circuit for them having just trashed his sanctuary city's executive order. What's going on there? Are we going to find out today?
Well, I wanted to do this today, but as it turns out, we're going to devote an entire episode to this on Friday. And I am going to, for the first time ever, I'm going to assign homework to Opening Arguments listeners. So I'm going to link the decision, which, by the way, I know you know this, but Donald Trump apparently doesn't know this, was a decision by the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California. Not a decision by the Ninth Circuit. It is fantastic reading, and all of our listeners should go read the case, and you will get a sneak preview of what we're going to talk about on Friday. But it will give you some ammunition, so I might start, if you're going to prep those arguments that you are having with your Trump-supporting family members, friends, and enemies that are on your social media feeds, I might start with the question, do you agree that Donald Trump and that his administration have the right to declare San Francisco a sanctuary city and withhold all funds, all federal funds from San Francisco? Because once you read the case, the answer might surprise you a little bit.
So. I love it. The answer indeed will surprise you. Awesome stuff. I'm not going to do that homework because you're not my real dad, but I get it. Okay. Well, everybody else who's, you are their real dad can do, no, I'm just kidding. Do your homework, everybody. Good stuff. All right. Let's go to our main segment for the day. All right, Andrew, I believe this is part two of our Choose Your Own Adventure segment that we were doing here. And I think it's time to choose the other adventure.
Yeah.
Right?
Last episode, you boarded the FCC train. And while on board the FCC train, you learned all about net neutrality and how that was put into effect with the Open Internet Order of 2010 that set forth three principles: the transparency principle, which ultimately passed and is still a valid regulation today, wasn't challenged. But the two critical prongs were the no blocking, right? That fixed broadband providers may not block lawful content, applications, services, or non-harmful devices, and no unreasonable discrimination in transmitting lawful network traffic. And taken together, those two things are at the core of the net neutrality movement, right? The idea that ISP providers shouldn't be able to discriminate against how information is transmitted over the internet, whether it is by Netflix or whether it is by opening arguments. And what you learned was that in the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, even though they rejected 6 out of 7 arguments made by Verizon, they accepted the last argument,
yeah,
right?
One,
which
yeah.
was that the scope of this regulation requires the FCC to consider ISPs to be Title II common carriers and not right. Title I information providers. And there's no harm in changing your mind, but because the FCC was classifying those ISPs as Title I and not Title II, the regulations went too far, exceeded the scope of delegated authority from the Congress. So we got to the end of that train, and now it's time to turn the page all the way back to page 2 in the book. Because I thought you'd choose this train first. I actually wrote this part first.
Just goes to show I'm unpredictable.
It is.
Right?
Well,
when you think
know,
I'm going to get a bar question wrong, I get it right. And when you think I'm going to get it right, I get it wrong. That's usually how it goes.
And when we play Choose Your Own Adventure, you actually got to choose. So I'm excited about that.
We just established free will does exist.
Yes.
Okay, let's go.
Okay. So your story continues with a callback to episodes 57 and 58, where we discuss the antitrust laws as applied to football, the USFL, and Donald Trump. And if you don't remember those episodes, haven't listened, they're a good episode. You should go back and listen. One of the players in that story against the USFL is the Federal Trade Commission, and they are also one of the good guys here in our story. Mm. The FTC's power begins with the FTC Act, which is 15 U.S.C. 45A1, and it says that, quote, unfair methods of competition in or affecting commerce and unfair or deceptive acts or practices in or affecting commerce are hereby declared unlawful. So broad grant of authority, right? And then subsection 2 says the FTC is hereby empowered and directed to prevent persons, partnerships, or corporations, .. And in that are some weird statutory exceptions like banks and savings and loan associations and other things. From using unfair methods of competition, which we just defined, in or affecting commerce, and unfair deceptive acts or practices in or affecting commerce, right? So you can't engage in these sort of broad behaviors, and the FTC can go after you, right? So as it turns out, that applies to the internet. So this is not a net neutrality format, but this is a more consumer protection oriented format. And in fact, the FTC has brought more than 100 privacy and data security cases and more than 150 cases against spammers and spyware, right? So pretty crucial in terms of when we think about government protecting consumers on the internet from commercial predatory activities, right? Under that same provision, the FTC has brought consumer protection actions against CompuServe, Prodigy, AOL, and other ISPs dating back to the 1990s. Thomas, I know you had an AOL installation CD at some point.
Ooh, yeah. Well, I still have stacks of them. They're going to come in handy.
At some
point.
Post-apocalypse. Those are going to be great. So look. From the earliest stages of the internet, the FTC has been out there aggressively taking actions against internet service providers, large and small, for unfair or deceptive consumer acts or practices. And so one of the areas that they recently turned their attention to is the area of throttling. I don't know if you know this behavior. This is when an internet service provider,
Comcast, throttling back Netflix, that kind of thing, that behavior to dialing back the speed of things that they decide they want to.
Is that exactly. Right. And so the way in which the FCC fought throttling was via net neutrality. Right. The way in which the FTC has fought throttling is via consumer protection. So in 2015, the FTC brought a complaint against TracFone. TracFone is the country's largest prepaid mobile phone service provider. It's a holding company. They have about 25 million total subscribers for, you know, burner prepaid phones. They do business under a variety of names, including Straight Talk Wireless, Net 10 Wireless, and Simple Mobile. I imagine that that's probably geographic. Like, I've heard of Straight Talk Wireless. I haven't heard of the others. I haven't heard of any of those,
yeah, but okay. I don't do as much drug dealing as you, so that could be why.
Fair enough. Their ads said, you get unlimited talk, text, and data, sometimes described as unlimited everything, for $45 prepaid per month. According to the lawsuit brought by the FTC, TracFone broke the unlimited data promise it made to millions of consumers almost immediately by having secret internal limits where it substantially reduced the speed of their service to the customers if they went over those non-disclosed internal limits. They throttled down at least 60%, sometimes 90%, which meant you couldn't send basic emails, right? Because you have to send the confirmation packet at the end of the email, and really rendered their data service almost entirely unusable. Wow. And of course, in some cases, they shut it off, right?
It's like when I was in Europe, it was pretty much that.
Yes, exactly. Anyway. So once people began to approach those fixed data limits, internal, non-disclosed limits, TracFone would send them a pre-recorded voicemail message that said, if your excessive data use continues, we may need to suspend or deactivate your data service or terminate your phone service altogether as specified in the terms and conditions of service.
But does this sound like a man who's had all he could eat right. data-wise?
Yeah,
that doesn't sound like
but it was not. Yeah, and it turned out they were not actually disclosed in the terms and conditions of service. And even in the advertisements, there was no fine print, John Machida style, super fast talking, reading the disclaimers. They just said, you get unlimited everything. And then they were like, oh, well, by unlimited, we mean limited.
Not even close to unlimited.
And so TracFone settled with the FTC. That settlement required them to clearly and conspicuously disclose any limits on the speed or quantity of its data service, to pay $40 million into a fund for consumers who had their internet service slowed down or shut off, and to change its advertising to disclose, you know, you get unlimited data up until where the limits kicked in. So good on the FTC. But the FTC didn't just go after TracFone. We said TracFone is the largest company that provides prepaid cellular service. They also went after a kind of larger player, AT&T. And you know, TracFone's big, AT&T is huge. They did not settle with the FTC. They litigated. So, but what AT&T was doing was almost exactly identical. Right. In 2007, AT&T became the exclusive service provider for the first iteration of the Apple iPhone and iPad. I don't know if you remember that. At the time, AT&T began offering unlimited data plans, and they did that for a couple of years. Unlimited data, fixed monthly rate. In June of 2010, AT&T stopped offering the unlimited mobile data plans, grandfathered in anybody who was on the data plans, but put everybody else on a certain amount of data per month.
Okay. I've had Verizon and they did that same thing. Interesting. Yeah. But okay.
And then they were trying to move all their legacy customers over to different plans that weren't unlimited. And in July 2011, AT&T decided to begin reducing the speed at which those unlimited grandfathered in data plan users received data on their smartphones. Under the throttling program, unlimited data plan customers were throttled for the remainder of a billing cycle once their data usage exceeded a certain internal non-disclosed threshold, right? So exactly like TrackPhone. And then AT&T said that it was necessary to prevent harm over their network because there was just too much data. I don't know. I mean, I kind of envisioned like, no, you can't have these many people run across this bridge or it will collapse. But I get the harm argument. But it didn't matter because the evidence showed that AT&T's program was not tied at all, that the only decision to implement it was, did the customer go over X amount?
Oh, yeah. It's not like the danger. There's no danger meter like at Homer's. I'm just doing all Simpsons references today. There's the server wasn't in meltdown or something.
Yeah, it didn't matter. They could have low traffic overall over their lines.
Right.
But if you hit that pre-existing data limit, they would start throttling your data.
Gotcha.
And the evidence at trial showed that AT&T did not regularly throttle its tiered plan customers, no matter how much data they used. Right. Because remember, in
because
the tiered plan.
For it?
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, you would think if you've got the meltdown, we can't allow another packet of data to go over it. You know, you would say, I'm sorry, I know you want to pay us, but you can't send any more data. The evidence is pretty clear that was pretextual. The case was brought in the Northern District of California and AT&T lost. That's where all those facts that I just described you came from. And AT&T appealed to that famously liberal circuit, the Ninth Circuit. Now, I want to talk about the two causes of action that were raised by the FTC against AT&T. In count one, the FTC asserted that AT&T's imposition of data speed restrictions on customers with contracts, quote, advertised as providing access to unlimited mobile data, and without terms, quote, providing that AT&T may modify, diminish, or impair the service of customers who use more than a specified amount of data, is an unfair trade act or practice. And then in count two, the FTC asserted that the AT&T's failure to disclose that it imposes significant and material data speed restrictions on unlimited mobile data plan customers who use more than a fixed amount of data in a given billing cycle is a deceptive act or practice, right? Mm-hmm. So seems pretty clear. Same conduct as TrackPhone. Same, hey, you get unlimited everything. And by unlimited everything, we mean we're going to start limiting you. Seems to fall within the FTC. So what happened in the Ninth Circuit? And the answer is, the Ninth Circuit just runs head on into the train you steered from the FCC, which is to say, I was slightly deceptive to you. The FTC Act, of which I read, that gives the FTC the power to prevent persons, partnerships, or corporations, accepting savings and loan, blah, blah, blah. Can you guess what I also omitted? What's also in that ellipsis?
Uh-oh, AT&T. Specifically, there's an AT&T clause.
There's an exception for common carriers. Common carriers may not be regulated by the FTC. So our delightfully well-meaning friends over at the FCC, we talked about Tim Wu.
Incredible.
Because, and the millions of Bernie bros, whom we love, who marched in the streets for net neutrality, faced with a DC Circuit Court opinion that said, hey, look, the only way to get net neutrality is to change your classification and to call ISPs Title II common carriers. Well, all those people are like, I don't know, what the hell is a Title I title? Call them Title II common carriers, right? So the FCC changed the characterization from Title I to Title II. ISPs became common carriers while this case was pending. And the Ninth Circuit said, yeah, the FTC Act prohibits the FTC from regulating common carriers. And AT&T Mobility is an ISP, an internet service provider. The FCC has just said they're a common carrier. So you no longer have any jurisdiction. And the consequence
but then,
of that.
In theory, though, it sounds like either way. Now, I know right now it sounds like, oh, we're screwed. Like we tried to do it with one, didn't work. Now and then kind of screwed over the other. In theory, though, one of these things has to work. Like either it's a common carrier or not. And if it is, then the FCC can regulate it. And if it's not, then the FTC?
Yes.
Was that what it was? Then the FTC can regulate it, right?
Right. But the problem is, I want you to think about what time it is now. This ruling comes out.
It's 12:22 p.m. for everybody listening.
This ruling comes out in the middle of 2016, right? all of a sudden, the FTC has no right. Remember, we went back to the stacks of AOL CDs. Yeah. The FTC is the body that has a regulatory history of protecting privacy and consumer fairness over the internet. The FCC's got nothing on that. And all of a sudden, a court has said FTC regs don't apply. They don't protect your privacy. FCC, you better come up with something. And they did. They came up with a 389-page document that was promulgated just by the end of November of 2016, really heroically. I mean, they got it done in a short period of time. But you might recall that something kind of important and catastrophic happened in early November of 2016.
No, I don't remember.
And those are the FCC regulations that Senate Joint Resolution 34 uses the Congressional Review Act within 30 working days of Congress to express their disapproval of and overturn. So the FCC rules never get put into effect because of Newt Gingrich's Congressional Review Act that we discussed in great length in episode 63. And now there's nothing, right? There are no promulgated internet privacy rules by a regulatory body with the administrative capacity to enforce them because of two very, very well-meaning liberal groups that cared about protecting your privacy on the internet.
They like canceled each other out, kind of.
Yeah. They
ran it. Yeah.
That's where they happened.
It was like two football players going to tackle the other team, the running back. And they just ran into each other.
And they hit each other. That's right.
And then the running back just kind of tiptoes into the, just walks into the end zone. Like, oh, okay. Wow. Okay.
Yes. This is the Darren Sproles theory of, no, that's exactly right. And so wow. I wanted to go through this because, this sort of law of unintended consequences is, you know, something you see, you don't see this every day.
Well, who the hell could have foreseen all that? So I don't blame him. I mean, that's
but it does, you know, it's something and, you know, and we've cracked wise, at our friends on the far left. I called them Bernie Bros again today. They have taken our abuse with some good nature to plumb, just like our handful of conservative listeners take our abuse with good nature to plumb.
Like Dan, the conservative man.
And that one libertarian party person. But no, I mean,
by the way, if you're a conservative, shoot us an email. You'll get referenced all the time as like our one conservative person. Right. But anyway, go.
But it illustrates a point that that you and I made politically throughout 2016, which is to say, before you want to call yourself a single issue voter, right? Before you want to say, the only thing I care about is my senator's position on net neutrality, and I'm going to vote you out in the primary unless you're pro net. Make sure you know 100%, right? Like, make sure you've heard the opening arguments on it. Make sure you know what the bill is, because...
Well, before you do anything, make sure you've heard opening arguments. Just, step one.
But, you know, I mean, this is... I think some of the train wreck nature of this is because once the notion of net neutrality got out there, that became a rallying cry, became a political point. And so as a result, you know, there was not a lot of deliberation back and forth. I could go into the history, but there was a very, very short period of time in which the FCC went from, we are not considering reclassifying ISPs as Title II, to we are considering reclassifying ISPs as Title II, to we've just reclassified ISPs as Title II. And I think that short period of deliberation was driven on by the political climate, the pro net neutrality climate, which again, we've said from the very beginning, incredibly well-meaning. But one of the things is that laws often mean more than their sound bites. And here was an unintended consequence of that. So, you know, so I offer that up as, you know, if you want to say, My principles are X, and I'm always going to vote for, you know, a pro-choice candidate over a pro-life candidate. I get that, right? But when you want to say your stance on this piece of legislation must be X, I would encourage you to have a little caution and a little humility with that, because you might be boarding a train that is headed for a collision. So there's our story.
Sproles might waltz in the end zone untouched.
Exactly. And if you're a Ravens fan, you hate that.
What a great story, Andrew. That's really cool. I mean, it's unfortunate, but complex. And thanks for breaking that down for us. Wow. There's where you there's your convoluted legal plot right there, movie makers. That's like a Big Short level plot right there that they'd have to pause in between and have like a good looking actress explain what's going on. That's like that level of plot detail.
Oh, I have suggestions for the actress.
Yeah. Let's do we need to get that on Opening Arguments. Okay.
There we go. Oh, new Patreon goal.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll do like the 5,000 level. We'll hire a model to explain some stuff that that'll work.
Yeah, we will definitely do that. Don't think this is a binding contract between us and our patrons right now.
Oh, man. All right. Thanks for breaking that down. Really interesting stuff. Let's onward to the rest of the show.
He who questions training only trains himself at asking questions. What?
Okay, Andrew. This is one that a lot of people have been asking about. I'll include, this could be a listener question. Listener Thomas S. asks, now, you've got it labeled as Ann Coulter's lawsuit, but it's not her lawsuit, right? Isn't it a lawsuit filed on behalf of some Republican groups and stuff against Berkeley?
Yeah, it is a lawsuit filed on behalf of the Berkeley College Republicans and the Young Americans for Freedom, which is a delightful, insane right-wing group. And look, by the way, like, I'm a big fan of that, right? Like, college is where you should
freedom.
Go to be exposed to crazy, insane ideas.
Right.
You know, there will be the, you know, Communist Party on campus and the Libertarian Party and the Objectivists who...
they let the Libertarians on college campuses these days.
Yeah, really.
When will it end?
Well, and the Objectivists who are like, those poser libertarians and their insufficient commitment to the ideals of objectivism. So, you know, yeah, like at Young Americans for Freedom is, they're the John Birch Society without the like chemtrails history. Like, they're nuts, okay?
Well, in case anybody doesn't know, let me make sure I have this right. So Ann Coulter was going to speak. It's a really convoluted thing because she was going to speak. There were protests. Then she wasn't going to. She pulled out and then she came back and she was like, okay, I will speak. And then she pulled out again, just like yesterday by our time. So I think it had to do with like the sponsors for her talk pulled their support because of the potential for danger. So she went back and forth like twice on this, which is really weird. And in the midst of all that, these groups filed a lawsuit against Berkeley, and I guess we'll find out the details from Andrew here. Is this a sound lawsuit?
Yeah. This lawsuit is delightfully mad. We are going to link it in the show notes. It's hilarious. And as longtime Opening Arguments listeners, I encourage you to open it up and listen and sort of, you know, spot the crazy, just sort of by comparison and notice, right. I mean, this is a good bookend. In the A segment, we talked about Trinity Lutheran's, petition and their briefs before the Supreme Court, right. I disagree with that position, but it's not laughable, right. Like, and in fact, the whole idea was, that, you know, their initial opening brief had a pretty good surface level of plausibility to it. This, one of our patrons in commenting on the website said, this reads more like a manifesto than a lawsuit, which I thought was a great way of describing it. I think somebody else said, awesome. You know, was this lawsuit scrawled in, you know, crayon or bodily fluids? And you read it, and yes.
Well, I can't wait for this.
The rhetoric, well, so some of the most ridiculous rhetoric is in the introduction. And and let me be fair to the law firm representing Berkeley College Republicans and YAF. You can take some liberties in the introduction.
That's where you can squeeze some like editorializing in a little bit, like kind of take some liberties on
right.
Gotcha.
That being said, you rarely get something like paragraph 2, which says, defendants engage in a pattern and practice of enforcing a recently adopted, unwritten, and unpublished policy that vests in university officials the unfettered discretion to unreasonably restrict the time, place, and manner of any campus event involving high-profile speakers, a term that is wholly undefined and that has enabled defendants to apply this policy in a discriminatory fashion, resulting in the marginalization of the expression of conservative viewpoints on campus by any notable conservative speaker. No, this is the best part. So that was sentence one, which is 9 lines. Long, which is good even for a lawyer, right?
Okay, now you have to go and then read sentence 2.
Yeah. And then the best one is sentence 2. Defendants freely admit that they have permitted the demands of a faceless, rabid, off-campus mob to dictate what speech is permitted at the center of campus during prime time and which speech may be marginalized, burdened, and regulated out of its very existence by this unlawful heckler's veto.
But this is what I don't get. I don't think the school ever disinvited her, right?
No. And the lawsuit doesn't claim that. What the lawsuit
See, it would be one thing if the school was saying like, no, sorry, we're never allowing you to speak. Get off our campus. This would still be dramatic, but at least it would, you know, it would have some basis of truth. But I don't know how they're making these claims.
Well, we'll go through, but okay. It's amazing how they do so. The argument, and that's why I did read the first sentence, even though it wasn't quite as funny. The argument is not that high profile conservative speakers have been disinvited from Berkeley, have been deplatformed. The argument is when controversial speakers have been invited, Berkeley has taken the position that they need to have appropriate security measures to ensure that when Milo gets up and starts doing his usual shtick of making fun of actual students on campus, right? Like the time he outed a trans woman and made fun of her from the stage, that in the school's view, that was highly likely to lead to potential violence. And so they wanted to have these kinds of speeches in a public setting and with sufficient security to make sure that people didn't get hurt. Okay. That's it. That's all Berkeley has done. And this lawsuit alleges that is a secret conspiracy designed to take only conservative speakers and put them at less desirable times and make them incur. The most hilarious part of this is the allegation that the cost of security that the college Republicans would have to take on would be $5,800 and that was, you know, oppressive. And I'm sitting there going, you just paid these more $20,000 to file this lawsuit, right? If anybody out there wants to send opening arguments $5,800, we will gladly take it. I don't want to say $5,800 isn't real money. It is. The Berkeley College Republicans, I am sure, have a speaker's budget that is probably in the six figures, right? Like wow. they can. Yeah, look, it's a large university, and you have to pay honorary and speaker's fees and fly people out there. And I am positive that they have sufficient funds to pay, you know, $5,800 in security costs. That's literally all it is, right? Like, so then the argument is the reason that they were moved to a different location is because there's this secret, unwritten, discriminatory policy designed to single out conservative speakers. So we've played around a little bit in the introduction and the facts. Good opening arguments listeners know that whenever you are looking at a lawsuit, the first thing you do is look to the actual causes of action, right? So scroll down to page 22.
You've also said you look at who wrote it, right? Isn't that another thing you do?
Yes, you do.
Yeah.
we can do that,
I'm guessing.
Yeah, and I have decided, because this is a smaller segment, that we are not going to make fun of the lawyers who are involved, but we could. And I invite our listeners to do the same.
Just remind everybody that we could. Yeah. It's time restrictions.
That's right. Like what a lawyer does is they first look, they see who's the lawyer who sent this to me, and they Google that lawyer and get a sense of the credentials.
Facebook
stuff.
Check out their vacation photos. Yeah.
So for example, you know, if you get a cease and desist letter in a copyright case, which I get all the time for my clients, right? Then I will look, and I treat that very differently if it shows up from somebody who is an intellectual property lawyer at a big law firm with you know, major credentials, or if it shows up from somebody and I go to their website and it's, you know, and most of their cases are personal injury, slip and fall, auto accident cases, right? Like, and you get both, right? So yeah, no, absolutely. You do that.
All right. So moving on though, because for lack of time, we'll have to skip that part, which would have been great, I'm sure.
Right. Which I invite all our listeners to do. go to page 22. So start at the first claim for relief. And that is bottom of page 22, violation of the First Amendment right to freedom of expression. And then parenthesis 42 USC 1983. I'm going to tell you without getting into 1983 claims, that's the federal statute that allows you to sue anybody acting under color of law for violating your civil rights, including your constitutional rights. Okay. So that's the mechanism. In other words, the First Amendment doesn't give you the right to sue somebody.
Yeah.
1983 says if somebody acting under color of law in certain circumstances violates your constitutional rights, you can sue them. So that's the vehicle to get
interesting.
In. But
okay.
the claim, you would analyze the claim under First Amendment right to freedom of expression, right? That's claim one. Claim two, First Amendment retaliation, which we will discuss in a second. Claim three, violation of the 14th Amendment right to due process. And claim four, and this one, we're going to start with claim four because I know you can analyze three and four just based on Thomas Takes the Bar Exam. Claim four, violation of the 14th Amendment right to equal protection. So wow. Let's start off. Equal protection claim is that Berkeley treats college Republicans and YAF differently from similarly situated students, student organizations, and members of the public because they are conservative and because of their conservative beliefs. So why is that?
Well, conservatives are a stupid, protected class in this country. So
it's one of those. That's exactly right. I want to point out Ann Coulter, the law firm you hired, wrote a cause of action so ridiculous that an unemployed comedian was able to dismantle it.
All right,
in
I get it.
Now
let's keep going. Keep
there
going.
You go.
Unemployed,
right.
Frumpy, not dressed very well, tired, just, you know, woke up late. Just keep going, Andrew. I get it.
I've got to play down your competence in order to play up how bad that is.
Oh, I love it.
No, but yeah, that's exactly right. So that's a nonsense argument. You know, what do you think of the due process argument?
Well, you just said due process. I don't know.
Yeah. I'm going to read you the entirety. I'm going to read you the entirety of their due process claim. Paragraph 111 is the incorporation paragraph. Paragraph 112. Defendants, acting under color of state law and according to a pattern and practice, have enacted the unwritten and or unpublished high-profile speaker policy, which is vague, overbroad, and improperly affords defendants absolute discretion in its application and therefore deprives BCR, Berkeley College Republicans, and YAF of their clearly established due process rights guaranteed by the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution. Paragraph 113. As a direct and proximate consequence of defendants' violations of BCR and YAF's federal civil rights, BCR and YAF have suffered and will suffer irreparable injury that cannot be fully compensated by an award of monetary damages. Therefore, they're entitled to declaratory relief. There you go. No, that's it. That's the sum and substance of that argument.
Well, I mean, first off, the first thing that came to my mind, which I'm not sure is where you're going, is like they talked about vagueness and how they're applying this thing. Didn't you read in the beginning, all they have to do is pay security costs and then it's fine or something? Like there was like $5,800 and how vague is that? That seems pretty specific to me. It's like, we'll just do this and you're fine.
That's a good point. But remember, we want to kick this out on a motion to dismiss. We don't want to get to the facts.
Oh, you're right.
We want to say even on the basis, right? Because the equal protection, we didn't get into.
Oh yeah. We said, even if you're right.
So
we don't want to get to the point where we're going through discovery and all that crap.
Exactly.
I see. So due process. Well, it just is there a dismissal on the grounds that it's unintelligible? Is that
Yeah, it is.
This is unintelligible garbage.
Yes, because to assert a due process violation, right, you have to say we have been, like, here's what happens.
What was violated without due process?
Right,
I don't even understand.
Exactly. Yeah. What process did you get? What was taken away? You either have to have a liberty or a property interest, mm-hmm. and it has to have been taken away, and you had insufficient property rights to
Right? Are they thinking, I'm just trying to get into what they're even trying to claim. Are they saying, like, you're First Amendment right was violated without due process or something?
I think that's what they're saying, okay. Which, you know, would make this entire claim contingent upon either
the First Amendment
question. Count one or two, okay. Right? But even then, they don't describe the process that was gone through. And in other words, you have to say, so if I were to deprive you of a particular liberty right, right? Suppose this actually did happen, right? Like the college Republicans are giving a speech and I say, you know, due to the crowd unruliness, the college Republicans are never allowed to speak on Berkeley's campus again, right? Well, then you would have a due process argument, right? You would say we have a liberty interest in speaking at the university and that was taken away from us. And the reason given was because it caused the crowd to be unruly, but we did not have the appropriate process to challenge that determination, right? Okay. Like we didn't get a hearing. We didn't get a trial. We didn't get anything, right? Like they just unilaterally said. But here, A, they don't identify what the liberty or property interest is. I think it's bringing Ann Coulter to campus, but we're going to get to that when we talk about counts one and two. But even if they did, they don't describe, in no way do they analyze having described the process in the facts section.
Well,
right?
Yeah, if they did, right, they would get to the point where Berkeley didn't even refuse her to, you know, like they didn't even disinvite her, right? I mean, that would inevitably come out as part of describing that process.
And so if, as we go through the process, it seems like the process is the imposition of the requirement that the speech be moved to a different location and that campus security be paid for, right? And I am pretty positive.
Well, that sounds like a process.
Yeah, right. And that determination, right, can be vested sort of with the sound discretion of the school. Right. Like that's precisely the kind of thing that a court is going to be like, like the school gets to decide, you know, when it's going to require campus security to be at an event. And what are you
talking
about?
But is that something they would have to proceed to in order to do? Would that be something you could get this dismissed on? Are you saying?
Yeah, I'm saying that it does not. So your thought of, I want to dismiss this because it's unintelligible, is actually what I would move to dismiss on the grounds that they've failed to plead with requisite specificity the required elements of the cause of action, right? Like they don't describe the liberty or property interest that's at stake, and they don't describe the procedures that were taken, and they don't give any analysis as to why those procedures were not the due procedure that was, you know, due to the individual involved, right? This is just a claim, particularly in federal court, a claim has to put you as the defendant on notice of what it is that you're supposed to defend, right? And
yeah, it sounds like they were just saying like bad things, like, due process. Yeah. Also, they were quartering soldiers in our, they're just like picking things from the Constitution that sound like they would be bad.
Right. So now let's move backwards to the second claim for relief, which is First Amendment retaliation. And this is another one of these that just, it's wrenched out of the context in which you bring First Amendment retaliation claims. Here's when you do, right? You bring a First Amendment retaliation claim when I am at work, I have engaged in a constitutionally protected activity, right? Like, so I have a little I voted sticker and I have Hillary Clinton signs in my office, right? And then my boss comes by and says, you went out and voted for Hillary Clinton and, you know, gave a speech on her. That's it. We're firing you, right? So you are being retaliated against. And again, this would have to be, I've said my cubicle, this has to be done under color of state law, right? So private employer can do that. We've already talked about that. But if this is your job at the government, for example, or this is a public university like Berkeley, Berkeley cannot come by and say, you voted for Hillary Clinton or you gave this constitutionally protected speech and therefore we're going to fire you. You would be able to bring
a private company can fire you for who you vote for?
Yeah. Oh, wow. A private company can pretty much
fire you
for anything.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, that's Right. That's the way to. And again, you know, it's worth saying don't take legal advice from a podcast, right? Like
all kinds of listeners are just firing employees right now. Oh, I can get rid of this Trump supporter.
Yeah, please don't take advice on that either way, right? Like all of those situations have nuance, but what I mean is that this particular cause of action, right, the First Amendment claim for retaliation under Section 1983 can only be brought against those who are acting under color of state law. Okay. And to act under color of state law, you either have to be an entity of the state or an instrumentality that is receiving state like a public university.
Is this something where they could sue just because Ann Coulter was denied? Because it seems like if somebody has standing, it would be Ann Coulter, not someone else. Or are they able to say because, you know, they invited her?
No, that's a great question. The lawsuit obviously focuses on Ann Coulter and Milo Yiannopoulos, and but as you know from our prior discussions on standing, BCR and YAF can't sue on behalf of Ann Coulter. Right.
Yeah.
Like, Ann Coulter has to sue on behalf of Ann Coulter. You've exactly anticipated what I was going to point out, which is here's how they have to plead this claim, because they are not the ones, if you think about it, they're not the ones who have engaged in the speech, right? Mm-hmm. They, if any retaliation has been done, it's retaliation against Coulter and Milo, right? Not against Yeah. Here's how they plead it. It's really interesting. Okay. BCR and its members have engaged in constitutionally protected speech, namely holding and expressing conservative viewpoints by inviting conservative speakers to speak on the UC Berkeley campus, including Milo Yiannopoulos, David Horowitz, and Ann Coulter. And then by treating BCR and its members differently, defendants acting under color of state law have engaged in actions that retaliate against BCR and its members for holding and expressing disfavored views and so retaliating, have engaged in a conduct that would chill a person of ordinary firmness from continuing to engage in the protected speech activity. So never mind that the second half of that is complete nonsense. Again, like we've talked about what retaliation means. It means we have, you know, fired you. We have deprived you of something to which you have a right, which just didn't happen here. And there's no way to characterize it that. The first half of that is a really interesting assertion. And that is they're saying it is our form of free expression to invite these speakers to campus. And however clever that is, I would point out now, and this is why we work backwards from counts four to counts one. When you go to count one, which is violation of the First Amendment right to freedom of expression, they say defendants acting under color of state law and according to a pattern and practice have marginalized or banned the expression of conservative viewpoints on the UC Berkeley campus. Well, in their own lawsuit, they've just pled that they expressed their conservative viewpoints by just inviting Ann Coulter to campus, right? So it's a pretty amazing kind of own goal. And by the way, Berkeley, you can send me, I'll take a thank you letter for writing your motion to dismiss this lawsuit here in about 20 minutes on the air. You can send that to Opening Arguments, care of Thomas Smith.
So we should
wrap it up. It's an amazing lawsuit. Berkeley will move to dismiss. It is possible that count one will survive just because if you find the right judge who says, I'm not going to throw everything out and we're going to let them, but it's not counts two, three, and four are completely laughable. And I don't think count one is very good. And that's why I pointed out kind of the own goal situation. It's hard to get rid of cases like this on a motion to dismiss for the reasons we have discussed many, many times on the show, right? That is, if there is any sort of factual dispute, the judge is going to say, well, let's go forward and find out what the facts are. Yeah. But here it's just pled in such a ridiculous way. And I mean, I didn't even talk about the fact that reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions are, I mean, I could literally quote five pages of nothing but Supreme Court citations that say, it does not infringe upon your free speech to have reasonable restrictions on time, place, and manner, right? Now,
yeah.
Could you, in a reply brief, could BCR come back and go, whether the restrictions are reasonable is a fact question, and, you know, we deserve the right to go to discovery to say, you know, that's the argument I would make on the other side. So
that,
you know,
still means, by the way, for anyone not clear, the lawsuit is still bullshit. It's just whether or not you can crumple it up and throw it away, or whether or not you have to like prove a couple of things and then
crumple it up. That's exactly right. Yeah. No. And there are lots of ways, as the defense lawyer here, that you would restrict what happens if you move forward, knock out almost everything on a motion, on an early motion to dismiss, but the court allows a version of the free speech argument to go forward. I don't want to predict, because predicting throwing out a fact intensive lawsuit on a motion to dismiss, right? That is a half court shot, right? Like that's a very low probability event. But it's very, very likely in this case for the reasons that we said. So there you go. Download, take a look at the lawsuit. It's hilarious. You will enjoy it. I have not begun to read some of the hysterical crayon scrawlings. and I am pretty sure, Thomas, that you're going to talk about this on Serious Inquiries Only from the public policy standpoint.
We'll see. I don't know. Yeah. Maybe I don't need to. Maybe you killed it.
There's all sorts of, I mean, these champions of free speech, you know, and frequent critics of precious snowflakes demanding that not only they get the right to speak at Berkeley, but they speak in this one particular hall on this one particular weekend, or if not, they're going to take the ball and go home, you know.
Just for anyone who, lest anyone think we're like anti-free speech or something, that's not at all true. I think both of us are pro-free speech. I think the biggest criticism with this stuff is people just play really loose with the facts. I mean, if it were true that campuses were banning Ann Coulter and were saying, no, we will not allow her to be heard here, that I would have a different opinion. I think you should allow people to be heard. But all they said was like, it's too dangerous on this day and time. We can't ensure campus safety. Reschedule to this day and time. And then it's a disaster. Like it's Lord
secret
of the Rings, like Mordor, like orcs are fighting, you know, humans, all this stuff.
It is a secret conspiracy to deny conservatives the right to speak at Berkeley. Yeah. No, look. Yeah. I want
talk
to emphasize
about
that.
Being triggered, by the way. Talk
yeah,
about
no,
being
seriously.
Triggered.
And I want to point out, because you and I do part company from, you know, some of our friends and colleagues, on the left, but we have both been a very, strong voice for free speech and for the sort of virtually untrammeled view of the First Amendment. I agree, right? If a public college or university said, we're not going to allow a student group to bring in Ann Coulter, David Horowitz, or Milo Yiannopoulos because those viewpoints are offensive, the ACLU would be out there with me, with you, challenging that policy, because that would violate the First Amendment. Absolutely, 100%. It would be wrong. Now, you know, I have said, I think when you're talking about somebody who is a professional troll like Milo Yiannopoulos, not to invite
story.
Him to
I
your
would,
school.
I would not put Ann Coulter in the same category as Milo. I mean, as bad as she is, I mean, Milo is horrible. Like
right. Universities are where you should be exposed to diverse viewpoints. That's how we began the segment. That's how I'd like to end the segment. We are pro free speech, but this lawsuit is not about free speech. How about that?
All right. There you have it, everybody. Good breakdown. Okay. It is time for our one of our co-favorite days, New Patron Tuesday. And we've got a lot of names to read. Thank you guys so much. Thank you to, right off the bat, Joe Kleinwalter Inc. Okay, that's close enough. I don't know how do you guys ensure that I always get the hard to pronounce ones? I swear we do no planning of who's going to read what. We just like kind of flip a coin, and then I have the impossible ones, including Mr. Mixelplick or whatever it was. Oh, that was so funny. Thank you, El Señor Del Fuego, Matthew Kurtz, Matthew K. Garling, Flawless Nirvana, James Turner, Kyle Reed, thank you, Robert, Mark Smith, thank you to Mr. Putafoot, Jack H. Levy, Tanner Baldus, David Groves, Zachary.
Yeah, thank you on a pledge edit to Thomas McCormick. Thank you to Michael Cox. Special thank you to Holly Foley, to Joel Hubbard. Thank you, Christopher Rapine. Thank you, John Bartlett. Thanks to Malcolm Boyack. Thanks, Lucinda Jennings, Chad Mazzell, last week's TTTBE winner. Thanks, Brent King. Ooh. Thank you on the pledge edit upwards to RJ Ratio. Thanks, Byron Gonzalez, Heath Gamar. Thank you to Stephanie, to Ben Hatcher, to Vegan Danimal, and thank you, Russell. Thank you all so much for your patron pledges.
Absolutely. You guys are the best. And there's a lot of awful movies probably out as we speak, I'm guessing. I mean, there's a little bit of time travel we have to do here, but let's think about this. Yeah, a lot of awful movies should be out probably today, if not already.
Lot of Awful Movies 6, Double Jeopardy starring Ashley Judd. This has widely been considered the worst legal movie of all time. We have some really strong candidates. So find out. Listen to Lot of Awful Movies. That's a $2 patron perk. Figure out if it truly is the worst. And we always have a lot of fun with those.
Absolutely. So I hope you enjoy that.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All right, now it is time for my co-least favorite time of the week, and that is TTTBE and the answer to the previous question. So currently, let's see, I'm 11 for 20. Is that right? So we get to find out if I drop down to 11 for 21 or if I'm going to go 12 for 21.
Yeah, this was a Thomas and our guest Phil Ferguson takes the bar exam.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I get to find out if I... Oh, man. This was a tough one. Okay.
Yes.
Let's see.
And so this was a pre-Obergefell question that said, let's assume a state guaranteed the right of same-sex marriage and then subsequently decided to repeal it. What would be the result of a lawsuit to declare that ballot initiative to repeal it void and reinstate the right of same-sex couples to marry?
Yeah, very tricky.
And your options, yeah, it is. It is. And I can tell you, having looked at the answer, the instructions I gave you, the pre-Obergefell instructions are correct. So neither of you were thrown off by that. So the proposed answers were A, yes, under the due process clause, no compelling state interest justifies denying same-sex couples the fundamental right to marry. B, yes, because under the Fourth Amendment, it would be an illegal interference against the right to privacy guaranteed to everyone. C, no, because the people voted to take a provision out of the existing Constitution, and when that is done by public vote, it cannot be altered. Or D, no, because the ballot proposition was properly placed on the ballot and all statutory procedures were followed, thus precluding the courts from taking adverse action. So we can start ruling some stuff out. Thomas, you guessed D, and Phil guessed A. So B,
rule those out.
Right. So B, for example, we can rule out, because, if it were a post Obergefell decision, right, a state is not going to be able to deprive.
Yeah. They wouldn't be able to do it in the first place. Right. That was
right.
What I was thinking. Okay.
Right. So B kind of makes sense if you think about what this, but it's just wrong. C, when that is done by a public vote, it cannot be altered. And that's just nonsense. And I don't think anybody even guessed that. And certainly not you and Phil. So now we're down to D and A.
Oh, great.
Right. The two answers. And
I was hoping we both got it wrong.
Yeah, no. And I'm sad to tell you that Phil got it right with A and you got it wrong. The 14th Amendment guarantees due process of law before the government can deprive an individual of life, liberty, or property. We talked about that actually a little bit in Ann Coulter's case. And so when you already have a liberty interest, then it's not enough to just say we democratically decided to take that away. When you single out a disfavored group and you take away a liberty interest that the courts have been very clear is among the core rights in the concept of ordered liberty, which is the right to get married.
How are you saying that? Oh, just marriage in general.
Right. Yeah. Marriage in general is one of those rights.
Just got the right to marry in this example, gay people. And then you said the courts have established established this as a but I guess you're saying marriage in general.
Marriage in general is one of the fundamental rights. And so you have it, you have acted under the authority of the state and the guarantees of the state, right? If you're a same-sex couple in this example, in going forth and get married and going to get married, and it's not enough to take that away from you to just say, 50.1% of our population doesn't like you anymore, so too bad, right? So in other words, I like this question. I'm sorry you got it wrong, because it shows the distinction between when you sort of place something up on the ballot, right, versus a right that people already have and an expectation that they already have under the law.
Where I struggled with this one, Andrew, was I was remembering Prop 8, and I didn't remember that it was just instantly struck down. And it was, in fact, as I do a little Googling here, it was upheld initially by the California Supreme Court. My intuition would be, if this is a bar exam question that even Phil Ferguson can get right, that any lawyer would have just said, no, I saw on the bar exam, this has to be struck down. But apparently it takes, apparently the California Supreme Court didn't pass the bar exam, but the Ninth Circuit. So the Ninth Circuit did pass
the bar. A U.S. District Court in the Northern District of California.
That's very interesting. So I kind of misremembered how Prop 8 went, I suppose, because it seems like on thinking about it, this is essentially Prop 8, the bar exam question. So very interesting. Well, this just goes to show that anybody can come on here and do better than I can on the bar. So that was the lesson we've learned here. Just any schmuck.
Thank you, Phil Ferguson, for appearing on the show, opening arguments program. Thomas will insult you at any time.
Yeah. So, Andrew, and this is actually current Andrew because, circumstances are, but current Andrew, although is future Andrew there? Because I would like to ask some stuff about. No, just
future Andrew is giving me some stock tips now.
Okay. So he's busy. Okay. Well, I'll settle for current Andrew. Who is our winner for this week's TTTGBE?
Yeah, today's winner is Colin Fraser on Twitter. That is at the Colin, ColinFraser. So hit him up, give him a follow and a shout out, who says, TTTBE, if A is wrong, I don't want to be right.
And I should have said that. Why didn't I say that?
I like that. A lot of folks wanted, we're sort of split. This week, I think like you, we had a lot of people who drew the comparisons between the debacle over California's Prop 8 and this question. We had a lot of people get it wrong. We had a lot of people take the pessimistic route of assuming that the law was just the law and we'd like it to be otherwise. But as it turns out, this is an example where the law and what we would like to have happen overlapped rather nicely. So hopefully this one really got me.
Sorry, everybody. I feel like I'm failing you.
It's a tough one.
A lot of people got it wrong. Look, you say I'm not the only one.
We've had a fair amount of discussion as you know, and as I think everyone listening to the show should know, we released the early answer to TTTBE to our patrons.
Patreon.com/law.
patreon.com/law. And there is, when we do that, it's a post and people comment on it and you and I will.
Yeah, half the time there's a riot that breaks out. Like when we post, they're like, no, I don't believe it. Seriously, there's a lot of people are like, this is not right. I don't accept. They go through all the five stages actually. Like, yeah. Well, okay, maybe if the, and then by the end, they're like, Thomas and I are all failing the bar.
So if you'd like to participate in those discussions, you can get on when we release the answers early, and it's not just a one-sided communication. We often kind of chat back and forth. It's a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Well, congratulations to this week's winner, who this time I'm here to congratulate instead of future Andrew. So I'll take that opportunity. Good job. Well, that does it for our show today. Thanks so much, Andrew. Thank you so much, listeners, for being so great, and patrons especially. Hope you enjoy that lot awful movies. And keep being out there reading legal documents with a renewed passion and zeal as you find you can kind of navigate your way around them, thanks to one Andrew Torres. So thanks for that, and we'll see you next time.
Stop breaking the law, asshole!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.